Hello, my name's Christopher James, and this is a new special series that I'm launching. An incredible man by the name of Boyd Anderson was brought to my attention several weeks ago. Boyd and I have now connected, and we've had multiple conversations that's going to lead to a multiple-part series. This first part involves MH17 and MH370, two horrific crashes that occurred, that we the people and our world have never been given the truth. Boyd has first-hand knowledge that is riveting. The first time that I saw this video that you're going to see, which is a pre-record, because I felt that I should show that because it was so well done, there's no point in me reinventing the wheel. After this, there will be multiple parts that will follow where we drill down on even further truths surrounding our country and our world. So sit back and enjoy this incredible interview with an incredible man who is a light to this world, Boyd Anderson.
FiveHundredAndThirtySeven, the number of votes that changed the course of American history.
Florida is too close to call.
The difference between what was and what could have been. So this year, if you're thinking that your vote doesn't count, that it won't matter, well, back then, there were probably at least 537 people who felt the same way. Make your voice heard. Vote.
I'm Barack Obama, and I approve this message.
So now I'm going to tell you my story. Back in 1972-73, I was playing hockey for the Medicine Hat Tigers in the WHL. That's the top junior league in Western Canada. I played alongside Lanny McDonald and Tom Lysiak. One night, October 7th, 1972, Lanny was actually in the penalty box. I scored 5 goals in 3 minutes and 7 seconds. Now, this is a record that nobody will ever break. In fact, if you divide 5 into 187 seconds, you'll get one goal every 37.4 seconds. So my hockey career, I ended up getting drafted by the New York Rangers, and I played a couple of years in the American League. But I got kind of sidetracked with an agent by the name of Richard Sorkin, which I won't get into too much detail. I ended up playing in Europe. I played in 5 different countries. And then I got into sales when I was around 30 years old. I ended up in 2006 getting into what they call quantum biofeedback medical devices. The device dealt on the principle that everything is energy, everything has a frequency. It was a device where you hooked up your wrists, your ankles, and your head with wires that hooked up to a box of frequencies and then into a laptop. The software was very diversified, and it would show the body's turning, and it was a diagnostic and a therapeutic device. It helped thousands of people all over the world. And I was put in charge of sales for the province of Ontario in Canada, 12 million people. I knew from my past sales experience that if I could tap into the ethnic groups, that I could sell a lot of these biofeedback devices. It was not regulated back in 2006. So first of all, I tapped into the Filipino community, the Chinese, the Russian, the Polish, and I was selling 5 or 6 a week. They were selling for $20,000 a piece. And one thing led to another. And one evening, a Lebanese Syrian gentleman came in with his girlfriend. His name was Tarek, and his girlfriend's name was Nancy. And after an hour of presenting the product to them, Tarek said, "My brother's got to see this thing." I said, "Where does your brother live?" His name was Jihad, and he lived in Dubai. There's a large Lebanese Syrian community in Ottawa, so that's where they were all from. But Jihad had, I guess, had enough of Canada, and he moved back to Dubai to live with his uncle. Their last name was Sharif. And they were close friends with the Bin Laden family, which has the largest construction company in the Middle East. So within 3 months, Jihad in Dubai helped me get a contract with a Saudi sheikh that was in charge of all the health and food for Saudi Arabia. He wanted to start 1,000 wellness clinics throughout the Middle East and put a device into each location. So I moved to Dubai. I sold everything. I had a penthouse in Waterloo at the Seagram Barrels warehouses. And I ended up selling everything and moving to Dubai in 2007. I was 53 years old. My book is titled Under the Radar 537-555. So throughout this story, you're going to hear the significance of those numbers, 537 and 555. When I moved to Dubai, I got introduced to Thomas. He was an established middleman that had been working with the Saudis. And he took a shine to me. I mean, he asked me if I wanted to go for lunch the first day I met him, and immediately started talking about over 55,000 tons of gold sitting on a military base in Thailand. I said, Thomas, come on, where did it come from? He says, well, I believe it came from the Shah of Iran. And in 1979, when the Ayatollah took over, they moved it to a military base in Thailand. Now, 1979, 79 is the atomic number for gold. There's a lot of coincidences in this story as we go along. I could tell Thomas was infatuated to want me to believe him. And he started showing me photos of all his gold. In the pictures, I saw a guy standing in the middle of all the gold in Thailand. I said, who's that? He says, oh, that's Richard, my partner. I said, really? I said, Richard who? He said, Richard Leibel. I said, Richard Leibel? I said, that sounds familiar. Is he from Canada? He said, yes. I said, is he from Saskatchewan? And he said, yes. And I said, you know what? My father told me about Richard Leibel. I said, what a coincidence. I said, I haven't been back to Saskatchewan since I was 15, and now I'm 53. And you're telling me about Richard Leibel in Saskatchewan as your partner. Well, my father told me that Richard Leibel got deported out of Canada for fraud and bringing in Asian money illegally. He actually put the water slides into Kenosi Lake where we had a cabin. He was actually married to a friend of mine's cousin. So it was quite an unbelievable coincidence. Anyway, he actually also started the Willis Golf Course in Saskatoon with a partner by the name of Red Schaefer. Anyway, I had a few conversations with Richard throughout that year, 2007. I spent every day with Thomas. My deal with the Saudis never did go through. And the reason was Quantum Alliance, who I worked for, had told everybody that it was a Class 2 medical device in Canada, but it turned out to be fraudulent. They had paid a guy in England to attach the medical device that I was selling to an existing Class 2 medical device that had nothing to do with biofeedback. So unfortunately, the Saudis put my deal on hold. So here I was in Dubai in 2007, it was September. I didn't have a whole lot of money. I had just sold my condo, but due to my tax situation, I ended up having to pay the government a lot of the equity that was in it. So I was in Dubai with a couple of credit cards and $10,000, living in a hotel, hanging out with Thomas every day. Now, Thomas kept intriguing me with this gold and kept asking me, you know, do you know so-and-so in Saskatchewan, of all places? Here I am half the way around the world. He's asking me if I know Harvey Schmidt in Saskatoon, who has a big grow up. He asked me if I knew the Hill family. He said he had strong contacts in Yorkton to this day, Yorkton, Saskatchewan. But I didn't know any of these people because I had left home when I was very young. Throughout the year, I met many people, a lot of sheiks. I also was asked if I wanted to fly over to Turkey to hook up a politician and a surgeon. So I had a girlfriend, Grace, who was my assistant, my associate. She flew over to Dubai, and together we flew to Turkey, and we were picked up in a black Mercedes by a gentleman by the name of Fuat, and took us right over to Erdogan's office. He was vice president at that time. Of course, I knew nothing about politics, and quite frankly, I was just trying to sell medical devices. I really didn't know how the world functioned. I had no idea who Erdogan was or what his rank was. But it turns out I shook hands with him, and Grace hooked him up to the biofeedback for about an hour, and I sat in the lobby, talked to Fuat, who told me Erdogan's whole background, how he was a professional football player in Istanbul, and also he became mayor of Istanbul, and then he got into politics. So after we hooked up Erdogan, we shook hands, said goodbye. Then we went to the main hospital, the biggest hospital in Istanbul, and hooked up the top surgeon. The device, the SCIO or the EPFX biofeedback device was quite subtle. So, you know, both Erdogan and the top surgeon kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, think about it. So Grace went back to Toronto and I went back to Dubai. And again, I hung out with Thomas every day. Now, I overheard a lot of conversations. I used to sit in his office playing backgammon on my laptop. And he would, he'd carry two cell phones, one in his right pocket and one in his left pocket. And he said to me, Boyd, and this is his quote, I work for the Swiss Jews, meaning, namely, Mark Rich. I didn't have a clue who Mark Rich was. He also used to talk about Barrick Gold, Peter Monk, the owner. He mentioned Eric Sprott, the Canadian gold guru. Harry Huko Kuroda, the CEO of the Bank of Japan, came to visit him two or three times that year. I had no idea who he was at the time. I used to sit in the lobby and talk with his wife, and she mentioned that they owned a house in Vancouver. As the year went on, getting into 2008 now in the spring, I was sitting in Thomas's office, and again, he kept talking about trying to get this gold down to Perth, Australia, okay? That was his main goal, was to get this 55,000 tons of gold that was 99.99% purity. It was ancient gold. It came from the Shah of Iran. And it sat on a military base for over 45 years in Thailand. And the idea was to try to get the first 2 tons out on a passenger plane down to Perth, Australia, where the World Gold Mint is. Because he always said, Boyd, once you remelt gold, nobody can prove where it came from. As I listened more carefully to his conversations, both of his phones would ring every so often. He always said the one in his right pocket was hooked up to the Swiss Jews, meaning the Jewish bankers. And I never knew who the other phone was hooked up to. But I overheard conversations where with Richard especially, where you know they'd have to try to find a pilot to put on a simulator so they could, you know, possibly take the plane up to 45,000 feet, cut off the oxygen, and all the passengers would die of asphyxiation. And quite frankly, I didn't know whether to believe him or not. I thought it was all legitimate. They were just trying to sell the gold off at a 20% discount. One day, Hussein Sizwani walked in. Now, Thomas, from the time I met him in September, would never stop talking about Hussein Sizwani. Hussein Sizwani was a very successful real estate developer in Dubai. And he came in to see Thomas 4 or 5 times when I was there. I actually hooked him up to the biofeedback device a couple of times, trying to get him to invest into my biofeedback business because I was just not selling any in Dubai. I attended the largest health show in the Dubai International Center, and I hooked up tens of people to my biofeedback, but just never sold any. Hussein Sizwani was very interested in the gold. In fact, Thomas, time after time, would try to convince Sizwani to invest into the gold. And they were talking $500-600 million. So later in the year, Thomas mentioned that he had just gotten back from laundering or washing about $10,000 worth of marked bills from another group of extremists in the Middle East. And it was a $10,000 sample of a $20 million package of American dollars that were all marked, because he said he was an alchemist and he knew the procedures of cleaning money, which kind of surprised me, because he wore a kippah under a baseball hat. He prayed twice a day. So I just took the assumption that maybe he was a Jesuit. I wasn't sure. Later in the summer, Mark Reich, as he pronounced it, came to Dubai. This was Thomas's banker. And Thomas mentioned many times that, Boyd, I'm going to set up a Swiss bank account for you. I'm going to have Mark, my banker from Zurich, come to Dubai and set up a Swiss bank account. Because once we get this gold, you know, we're going to be rich. We're going to have a lot of money, and they'll deposit it right into your Swiss bank account. So about the middle of July 2008, Mark Reich came to Dubai. He stayed at the Marriott just down the road. And Thomas and I and another gentleman by the name of Dimitri met Mark at the bottom of the Marriott, at the sports bar at the bottom of the Marriott just down the street. Now Mark Reich, he pronounced himself with a German accent. I had no idea who he was. I thought he was a depressed banker that just lost his job, because he looked rather melancholy. He lit up a big Cuban cigar. And I just sat and listened to the conversation. The only thing I did say was, are you going to get the gold out of Thailand? And he simply looked at me and said, yes. So around this time, a year had gone by and I was actually running out of cash. So I said to Thomas, listen, I got to get back to Canada, but I am going to stop into Bangkok on my way back and visit Richard. So about a day before I left Dubai, around the end of July in 2008, Thomas hands me a 20-page document in an envelope that hadn't even been opened. And he said, here, have a look. So I took it outside and I opened the envelope. And it was about a 20-page document all about Bitcoin. Of course, this is before Bitcoin came on the market. It was all about the blockchain, the ledger on the internet that the Bitcoins run on, and the fact that the Swiss Jewish bankers have the code. It talked about Brexit, how England was going to separate from the European Union. This is 8 years before it happened. It talked about ISIS. I forgot to mention that in April of 2008, Thomas asked me to leave the office for a few minutes, that he had a meeting. And as I was walking out, Al Baghdadi was walking in with three other Arabs. Now, I didn't know who he was at the time, but I definitely recognize him today as I see his picture all over the newspapers. So when I questioned Thomas, you know, after the meeting with Al-Baghdadi, I said, who are those guys? He says, oh, just some extremists, no big deal. He just shrugged it off. So the day before I left Dubai in the end of July 2008, after reading this 20-page document, it was all about, again, Bitcoin, the blockchain, how they have the code, which means they can steal your money. Kraken, release the Kraken, which I'll get to in a few minutes. The creation of ISIS, Brexit. They talked about the election in 2016 in the United States. It talked about interest rate hikes that we're seeing today that will continue to go on. And the fact that they want to try to disrupt the economy in the United States. So with this information, Thomas, I handed him back the envelope and he said, oh, by the way, Boyd, Richard just found a pilot from Malaysian Airlines to put on a simulator. So without hesitating, I said, well, what are you going to give him? He says, oh, probably 10 million US and a villa in Bali. So honestly, I didn't know whether to believe this story or not, but I hopped on a plane the next day to Canada via Bangkok, and I got off in Bangkok. I spent 5 days. I visited with Richard for three of them, and he basically confirmed everything. He knew about my hockey record, 5 goals in 3 minutes and 7 seconds, because that became my number. 5307 had been my favorite number, and I used it as my password. I shouldn't tell everybody, but I'll be honest with you, it was my number my whole life. And of course, he knew about my record. He knew nobody would ever break it. He also confirmed that he had been writing what was now called the 14-year plan for the New World Order. This is what I read. And it took him 7 years to write this whole program. And he also wrote the code for Bitcoin, along with a few other of his assistants. He also mentioned that they just found a Malaysian airline pilot to go on a simulator. This is in 2008. All he said was, Boyd, we're gonna get the gold out of Thailand. We're gonna get it out on a passenger plane, and someday you'll hear about it. So that was it. I didn't understand why they were telling me all these things. They kept promising me millions, a lot of talk. So I hopped on a plane and went back to Canada. Ended up in a city in Saskatchewan, because that's where my mother lives. It's called Saskatoon. I had no idea what I was going to do in Saskatoon. I had come back from Dubai with not a lot of money. I noticed the high crime rate, so I actually got into selling security systems. And I sold 77 my first month. So I thought, wow, I can do this. So I continued to do this for 2 years. And in the meantime, I met a beautiful girl in Saskatoon, started a relationship. I kept phoning Thomas just to see what's going on, because I actually left two of my devices with him. I left him a brand new device and a used one and some clothes, thinking I would go back, because he did intrigue me with this gold. So 2 years go by, and now it's the middle of June, and out of the blue, I get an email from a Marley Thomas. In her email, she mentioned that she owned a spa at the Dubai Mall. Now, the Dubai Mall is a 7-story high mall at the bottom of the Khalifa, which is the tallest building in the world. It's a beautiful mall. She said she owned a spa called Sparkles. Now, what clicked in my mind at that minute, when I told my story to Thomas about the 5 goals that I scored in 3 minutes and 7 seconds, I said, when I scored the 5th one, I was on such a natural high, I saw sparkles. So again, the alarms went off when she said sparkles. I didn't think too much of it. She said she wanted to buy one of my medical devices. So I sent her a reply, and I said, well, you must have seen me at a mall show back in 2007. She never replied. She just said, you know, we made a deal over the emails. And again, I got in touch with Thomas. I had his phone number, and I told him I'd be coming back to Dubai to sell a device. So when I got to Dubai, I called Thomas and I told him where I was. And I said, please bring me my stuff in the morning, because I got to go sell this device to this Marley Thomas. He says, well, okay, I'll do that. So in the morning, he was like Johnny on the spot. He brought the devices over, all my clothes. And as he was handing everything over, he said, Boyd, let's go for dinner later. I said, fine. So I took a cab over to the Dubai Mall. I made the deal with Marley Thomas, a bubbly English blonde lady, very good, very attractive. And after the deal was done, all of a sudden, she brings out photos of her so-called boyfriend in Fort Lauderdale standing in front of a Ferrari. And I'm thinking it to the back of my mind, why is she showing me photos of her so-called boyfriend in Fort Lauderdale? But now I do, and I'll get to that later. So that evening, I went out for dinner with Thomas, and we're sitting there at the table, and he starts flipping a Bitcoin in the air. This is June of 2010. He says, Boyd, they're worth 30 cents now. Do you want to get involved? And he said, by the way, Hussein Shizwani just committed $600 million to the gold. And I had this feeling of wealth go through my body. I got red in the face. I hadn't experienced that feeling before. It was a feeling of extreme wealth. But then I remembered what Xi had told me back in 2007, the gentleman that helped me get the biofeedback contract with Saudi Arabia for the medical devices. He had told me and warned me, he said, Boyd, Thomas will chew you up and spit you out. So that took over at that point in my mind. And I looked at Thomas and I said, listen, I said, you're the money launderer. I'm a salesman. I'm going back to Canada. Pay me back when you can, because he owed me some money. So the very next day, I hopped on a plane, came back to Canada. I deleted his phone number off my phone because I knew there was something fishy about the lady sending me the email and Thomas. So I just decided to put that behind me and carry on. So I deleted his phone number off my phone and I never communicated with him again for 4 years. I got back into the security business. And in 2012, I got kind of tired of knocking on doors selling security. So I happened to call an old friend of mine from my previous sales past in Ontario. And he had just started a company called Pristine LED. It was an assembly plant in Windsor, Ontario. So I became part owner of Pristine LED, an assembly plant in Windsor. And because I'm an old New York Ranger, I decided to call an old friend of mine by the name of Ron Greshner, who played for the Rangers for 16 years. We actually started together in Estevan, Saskatchewan when we were 15. We both got drafted by the Rangers together. We both went to Providence together in the American League. But after only spending 5 games in Providence, Ron was brought up to the NHL, and he spent 16 years in New York. Anyway, one thing led to another, and he formed a company called Four Beginnings with Kathy P., who was CEO of Quality Health Control for Homeland Security. So the next thing you know, they've got me going from Indiana to Grand Rapids to Houston to all these big trade shows. I couldn't believe the big industry that the prisons are. They have fish farms, they have all kinds of things. So I did audits at the Jamaica Queens Prison. I did audits at the Indiana State Prison for Women, 26 buildings. It took me 8 hours to do the audit count. And while I'm doing that, Ron and Kathy, his partner, are having dinner with Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, who today is Donald Trump's vice president. I didn't think anything of it. I thought maybe we can sell some more lights. Anyway, this went on for about a year, and I just couldn't find any prisons who wanted to buy our lights. So they kept putting us off. So I started to focus on the local community here in Saskatoon and Calgary. And on March the 8th, 2014, I was sitting at the Willows Golf Course, ironically the same golf course that got Richard Leibel deported 15 years earlier. I'm sitting there having breakfast when CNN announces MH370 has gone missing. I blurted out, I know who did this, and people looked at me, but I knew it was the gold heist that I'd heard about years before. So my mother and I are born on the same day, the Ides of March, March 15th, night. And I said to my mother on my birthday, I think Thomas is behind this. So I started to do some research. And I found out that 20 of the people who were on board MH370 were employees of Freescale Semiconductors, which is owned by the Rothschilds. And 4 of them had a patent on a wafer-thin semiconductor that was coming out on March 14th. And the only way the Freescale could get 100% would be to kill them before the 14th of March. That's interesting. Then I found out that Boeing, who makes the 777, when they make a 77, they make duplicates, and because it's cheaper. And who owns Boeing is the Rothschilds. So, doing my research, I also found that a girl who they had brought in to be CEO of Bitcoin Southeast Asia, living in Singapore, had mysteriously fallen off her balcony 16 stories to her death. Her name was Autumn Radke. Now, coincidentally, at the same time, I'm trying to do a website for my LED lighting business, and I wanted to use my hockey record, 5307, because I thought people would wonder what 5307 is all about, and I maybe could do some hockey arenas, convert them over to LED lighting, which I actually did. But I looked up the meaning of 5307 in the Hebrew Greek dictionary, and just about fell off my chair when it said the definition of 5307 is to fall to a violent death. Well, then I quickly got inspired to look up the name Autumn, the lady who had just mysteriously fallen off her balcony. Autumn in the Hebrew Greek dictionary means the falling of the leaves. So now I started to get curious, and I had to find out exactly what's going on. I also found out that a Bitcoin just 2 months prior to MH370's disappearance had gone up to $1,100 US. And I thought, wow, I could have had a million of them. But that's when I started to do my research. I didn't have Thomas's phone number, but I did have his email. So I sent him a quick email, and I wanted to get a response. So all I said was, "You did it." I waited a few days, never got a reply. Continued doing some research. Found out that Bitcoin, there was many, many, many robberies of Bitcoin. Many exchanges got robbed of millions and millions of dollars. Mt. Gox in Japan was robbed a month before MH370 disappeared for $850 million worth of Bitcoin. Mt. Gox did all their guns and nuclear weapons. Silk Road, a month before MH370 went missing, got robbed in the United States. Silk Road did all their drug cartel for another $750 million worth of Bitcoin. So altogether, in just those two exchanges, there was $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin. Now, who became the regulator in the world for Bitcoin at that time was Kraken. Again, I couldn't believe it. So everything was coming true. Kraken, which was invented just after MH370 disappeared, was a Bitcoin exchange, a cryptocurrency exchange in San Francisco. And when they released the Kraken can eat up all the Bitcoin in the market. They actually tested it out in 2016 with Ethereum. Ethereum in June of 2016 was worth $400, and within 1 second it went down to 10 cents and then back up again. That is what you call releasing the Kraken. So whenever you see large fluctuations in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, they are releasing the Kraken, and it's there to destroy countries that rely on Bitcoin and humans. So I'm just giving everybody a heads up. Now, as I started to dig into this more, I Googled Thomas's name. Thomas Lilly Kazansky is what he told me his name was. And a Forex FX website came up. There was no place to leave a message. There was no phone number, but there was a place to type in a message. So I typed in, "Please have Thomas Lilly Kazansky call Boyd Anderson immediately with my phone number." This is a week after MH370 took place. Within 2 minutes, my phone rings, and it's Thomas. He said, "Boyd, how are you?" I said, "I'm fine, Thomas." I didn't hesitate. I said, "Thomas, I've been reading about Bitcoin. I've been reading about MH370. I said, "You've been a busy guy." Zip. There was 5 seconds of silence. I thought he was going to hang up, and he probably should have. But then he calmly replied, "Boyd, you are very smart. Yes, we got $200 million for MH370. You are smart. You are very smart." He kept repeating it. Now, that's probably because I never contacted him for 4 years, but I just went on my gut instinct that he was a bad dude. So we probably had 10 conversations that spring, but I couldn't prove how they could get 55,000 tons of gold down to Perth. I just wanted to get as much information out of him as possible. So around the third phone call, I emailed him my quotes from Homeland Security prisons for my LED lighting. And within seconds, the phone rang. He called me. He says, "Boyd, those are all my other contacts." So I put it together. In one pocket, the cell phone was hooked up to the Swiss Jewish bankers, meaning Mark Rich and company. And his other cell phone was hooked up to Homeland Security, because he did mention to me in 2007 that he was friends with Jay Johnson's father. Now, Jay Johnson was the chief of Homeland Security. So I truly believe Homeland Security is responsible for creating ISIS, along with Israel and the Swiss Jews. They put a prison into Iraq in 2002, which allowed all the al-Baghdadis to get together under one roof and do their planning. So this is all going on in my mind, and during that summer, I mean, Thomas invited me to a Bilderberg meeting in Hong Kong. He sent me a contract for $575,000 for helping him out in 2007, and I just was going along with it. He mentioned to me in August that the people from MH370 are never coming back. I said, "Where are they? In the Indian Ocean?" Because I had no idea. And finally, in September, 5 months after MH370 took place, the last conversation I had with Thomas was, "Boyd, now that we got the gold, we got to sell it." And he says, "You got to realize where money originates from." So that was the last conversation I had. I quickly Googled the origin of money, and it's Turkey and Greece. And a lot of this information you'll get in my book. But 3 days later, I get a phone call in the middle of the night from an Ivan with a South African accent. Now, he said, "Boyd, this is Ivan. I'm Thomas' South African friend. I'm just calling you to tell you that Thomas had a stroke, and he's talking like a baby, and we're not sure he's going to recover." So as soon as he said, "talking like a baby," I knew Thomas was right beside him telling him what to say, because he used to use that phrase when I was with him in 2007, you know, for fun, talking like a baby. So this Ivan had a sharp South African accent. So I wondered who he was. So anyway, I kept doing my research, and finally in January 2016, I discovered that there were three jumbo 747s left abandoned at the Kuala Lumpur airport for over a year. They sat there on the tarmac. Nobody claimed them. I mean, sometimes I forget where I leave my car in the parking lot, but who forgets where they leave their jumbo 747? In fact, three of them. So the story was all about the airport auctioning them off, and the proceeds would go to pay for the storage of these three jumbos. Two of them came from Icelandic Air, and one came from what I believe Abdul Mowbray in Fort Lauderdale. That's getting back to the relationship that this Marley Thomas, I found out later, looking on television, I recognized her as an anchor with Bloomberg. Her name is Caroline Hyde, a beautiful English girl, blonde. I mean, it's not difficult to recognize her. So when I found out about these three jumbo 747s, I just said, "Cha-ching. This is it. Bingo." Now I had solved 99% of the mystery of MH370. There were five planes involved. Okay, there were two identical 777s. there were three jumbo 747s. Now, just after midnight on March the 8th, it was March the 7th, Western time, again, third month, seventh day, five planes involved, 537. There were two MH370 leaves Kuala Lumpur with 239 people on board. They had smuggled 2 tons of the gold from the military base onto MH370. That was the 2 tons Thomas always talked about. They described it on the manifest as 2 tons of mangosteen, but obviously the people at the airport were involved with this, so it was actually 2 tons of gold. MH370 takes off. The pilot had been on a simulator for 6 years, practicing what he was about to do. He takes off, and over the Bay of Thailand, which is the Strait of Malacca, takes the plane up to 45,000 feet, as recorded by the New York Times. At the same time, MH17, you know, the 777 that went down over Russia 4 months later, they say the Russians shot it down with a missile. Well, that's not true. I'll tell you about that one in a minute. But MH17 comes flying by. Now, the people behind this was the CIA, Department of Homeland Securities, the Russian KGB, and the Israeli Mossad. Okay? They came flying by in the identical twin to MH370, which is MH17. And it picked up the radar, because both planes were equipped with onboard explosives, stealth technology, which means they can pick up the radar, turn it off, and autopilot. MH370 stays up for 23 minutes to make sure everybody's dead of asphyxiation. Then it comes down under the radar, that's why I named the book Under the Radar, and it lands on the northern tip of Indonesia at an airport called Banda Aceh. It can handle a 777. That's where they offload the 2 tons of gold, and then MH370 goes north to Kazakhstan. They hide it in the Cosmodrome, that's a Russian spaceport. Now, I forgot to mention that Thomas was looking after the president of Kazakhstan's nephew, Rahim. I met him many times. He treated him like his son. And he always said, boy, we can use the Cosmodrome if we need it. So this is what happened. They stashed it away for 3.5 months. They hid it. And I'll get back to what happens next with MH370. All the bodies were drained of blood. MH17 then circles down under the radar, cuts off its radar, and lands at Banda Aceh Airport, picks up the 2 tons of gold, and heads down to Perth immediately, and opens up the account at the World Gold Mint. And Tony Abbott, the Prime Minister, was on television all the time pointing at the Indian Ocean, trying to get everybody to do the search. Meanwhile, MH370 is sitting in Kazakhstan. So they begin this search in the Indian Ocean, and the search went on for 10 months. But while they're doing the search, Thomas and the Swiss Jews are flying back and forth with the three jumbo 747s with the gold, as if they're part of the search, right in front of the world's eyes. Now, who paid for it? It cost $130 million for that search. The taxpayers paid for them to transport the gold down to Perth. This is how ridiculous this whole thing is, right in front of the world's eyes. Now, the mathematics goes back to the same 537. Each jumbo 747, the capacity of a jumbo 747 is 400 tons. So they made 50 trips, because you got to get the five in there. They worship the number five. This is from Shivaism. Shiva is the god of destruction, the destroyer. And you've heard of CERN. That's in Geneva, Switzerland. It's a big collider. It's actually the headquarters of the CIA as well. 15,000 people commute every day through 6 different tunnels, Switzerland. Well, India donated in 2004, donated a statue of Shiva, a 4-foot statue. And Shiva is, again, the god of destruction, the destroyer, and they worship the number five. That's why they knew I had the numbers. 5 goals in 3 minutes and 7 seconds. Now, we're talking about transporting the gold from Thailand to Perth. Each jumbo 747 made 50 trips. Over 5 months, that's 10 a month, with 370 tons per trip. So when you multiply 370 times 50, you get 18,500 times 3 of them is 555. It took them 5 months. And when I thought about it, from the time MH370 happened in March till the last conversation I had with Thomas in September, it was just past the 5 month time frame. And that's when he said, Boyd, now that we got the gold, we got to sell it. Now, in the meantime, 4 months after MH370 disappears, MH17 gets supposedly shot down over the Ukraine. So on July 17th, 2014, MH17 leaves Amsterdam with 298 people on board. The flight path to Kuala Lumpur wasn't even supposed to go over the Ukraine. And the ironic thing, another coincidence, is that it was MH17's 17th birthday to the day. Both MH17 and MH370 were identical twins. Their maiden flights were on July 17, 1997. So 17 years to the day, coincidental, MH17 takes off with 298 people. Now, this is when they resurrect MH370. Believe it or not, it becomes very biblical. It's like when Jesus was resurrected after 3 days. This is after 3 months. They had resurrected MH370. The Ukrainian, and I have all this on video and referenced in my book, the Ukrainian farmers witnessed a jumbo 747 practicing in the farmland of the Ukraine with a Ukrainian Su-25 fighter jet right underneath it. For 2 weeks, this went on. They'd never seen anything like it. So this is what happened. They resurrect MH370 on July 17th, and it's flying autopilot in parallel with MH17 over the Polish airspace. And they go 1 degree to the north over the fighting area of the Ukraine. And this is when the Ukrainian fighter jet blasts a hole into the cockpit of MH17, and it starts to descend. Now, the Ukrainian Su-25 fighter jet follows it down, peppering it with 33-millimeter shells to make it look like it got hit by a missile. At the same time, they wirelessly explode MH370 in midair, and it breaks apart into bigger pieces. It caused 3-foot holes in the earth, and it lands in the northern part of the Ukraine. The body parts, being 4 months old, were rotting and decomposing. They were spread 33 kilometers apart. The first responders and even a Ukrainian commander in the army expressed publicly with the press that the bodies were not fresh. They had been dead for days, and they smell of rotting and decomposition. Now, MH17 continues to descend, getting peppered with 33-millimeter shells from the Ukrainian fighter jet, and then they explode it remote-controlling, and it explodes, but closer to the ground, only about 100 meters off the ground, so it doesn't spread as far. Now, when you add up the total amount of people on both flights, 239 aboard MH370, 298 aboard MH17, you add them up, what do you get? 537. Now, what happened to the gold? After they remelted the gold in September, they used those same three jumbo 747s to transport the gold into 7 vaults around the world. There's a vault in Singapore, Hong Kong, Dubai, Zurich, London, Toronto, and New York. Now, the atomic number for gold is 79. So they put 79 tons into each vault. 79 times 7 is 553, plus the 2 tons that were on the original 370 brings it back to 555. So when I started to do more research on this, I found out that the only company that has access to these 7 vaults is Gold Money. It's called BitGold, which I had read about in the original 20-page document. It started off as BitGold on the Toronto Stock Exchange. It went right up to $8 in 2015. It's around $2.95 right now. But it's the only company that's changed their name to Gold Money. They put the headquarters now off the Isle of Jersey, and it's actually a Rothschild's company. It's the only company in the world that has access to these 7 vaults. And this is what's going to run the New World Order, along with Bitcoin and all the cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin will probably crash within the year, my prediction. But how did they sell the gold? They crashed the stock market in 2016. It was the worst crash in the history of Wall Street, January. I did a lot of research. I found out who Mark Rich was. He started Glencore, a very criminal company. It's the largest commodities and mining company in the world. And he supposedly died in 2013, because I remember getting a phone call in June of 2013 saying, you know, from a Swiss bank saying, do you want to keep your bank account open? And I said, no, close it, because I hadn't communicated with these guys for over 3 years then. But who took over Glencore is Ivan Glasenberg, who speaks in a sharp South African accent. So this is part of my story. This is, to carry on a little bit, I mean, they created a lot of black ops. They had Erdogan in Turkey shoot down a Russian fighter jet in the fall of 2015, because you see gold's price had been dropping since 2011, and it had dropped down to just over $1,000. And Barrick gold stock, I watched it, had dropped down to $8. And be darned if John Baird, Canada's former Minister of Foreign Affairs, quits the government and goes to work for Barrick Gold. Now, why would he do that? So they had to drive the price of gold back up. And that's why they created Brexit, fear and uncertainty. They had Erdogan from Turkey shoot down the Russian fighter jet. They had all these black ops in Paris and Brussels and Florida. And it was all to create fear and uncertainty. They created ISIS to remove all the refugees, to create all these refugees from Africa, from Iraq, to flood Europe. And it was all to do with raising up the price of gold. So that's what happened. The biggest winner in Brexit, because of course they knew about it before it happened, was George Soros and Kazakhstan. They're the ones that made the most money. It's all in my book. George Soros in May invested $438 million into Barrick Gold. And now you can see that he capitalized on Brexit. So as we go along, Glencore, who have their headquarters in Regina, Saskatchewan, in January of 2016, another thing happened is Ivan Glasenberg unloaded 40% of his agricultural business to the Canadian pension plans. And they were able to buy into Glencore at $71. I mean, 2 years prior, it was a $500 stock. Now the Canadian pension plans bought in at $71. Today, it's back up to $400. So the Canadian pension plans are loaded, because you see, commodity mining is kind of going on the way down because they want to replace gold with Bitcoin and all these cryptocurrencies. So agriculture is now on the way up. So now you've got Glencore trying to do a takeover of Bunge.
Glencore is once again on the hunt for deals, including the approach you made to Bunge. Here's what I'd like to know, and I think helps to inform people about your company and about how you think. Why does Bunge interest you, and what do Glencore's ambitions say about your expectations for the health of the global trading system?
Yeah, Bunge, we've always said we got three real departments within Glencore. We have the metals and mining side, mainly metals. We have the oil side, energy, coal and oil. And then we have the agricultural part of Glencore. In the metals and mining side, we are one of the three biggest mining companies in the world. Oil, we're a bit smaller, but pretty big in the oil trading side, where we handle around about 5 million barrels of oil a day. So pretty big on the trading side. In the ags, we weren't the big player. So what we decided a while ago, during 2015, if we could bring in partners, and we brought in a partner into our ag business, we brought in the two Canadian pension companies, but we wanted partners who wanted the same ambitions as us and wanted to grow the business.
Backed by the Canadian pension plans, and their headquarters happens to be in Humboldt and Nipawin. Another coincidence, thinking about the Humboldt Broncos. And right on that corner where the crash was for the Humboldt Broncos is a huge Bunge site. So, are these all coincidences? I went in to look up the significance of 537 and also 555. And here's what I found. This goes back to the people who run the world, you know, these Jewish bankers in Israel, etc. And Putin, of course, and Trump. You see, I didn't know if Trump was involved until January 2017, when he announces to the world that his best friend and business partner, Hussein Shizwani, the guy that backed the gold heist, is his best friend and business partner. And again, I just about fell off my chair. Now, doing my reference on 537, in the Bible, 537 BC is when Cyrus, who was a Persian emperor, captured Babylon. He was married to Isis. That's when he freed 50,000 Jews and allowed them to go back to Jerusalem to rebuild their second temple. And again, referring to Trump, this is why Trump is moving, or has moved, the embassy to Jerusalem so they can build a third temple. It's all about the next coming of Christ. Now, 537 AD was the first siege of Rome, when the Ostrogoths tried to capture the Roman Empire, and the Pope was saved by a Byzantine general, a Muslim general. His name was Vigilius. And this is when they stuck a Byzantine Pope in, and he reigned from 537 to 555 AD. Now, in the year 2000, when George Bush ran for president, they had to recount the votes. This is George Bush versus Al Gore, and they had to recount the votes in Florida. And of course, who's the governor of Florida? Is George's brother Jeb. So they recounted the votes. And do you know how many votes he won by? 537.
537. The number of votes that changed the course of American history.
Florida is too close to call.
The difference between what was and what could have been.
So this is why in 2012, when Obama ran for president on his second term, his whole ad campaign, and you can Google this right now, just Google Obama 537, and you will get an advertisement. His whole advertisement campaign was 537. Get out and vote, everybody. The number that changed the history of America. The difference of what was and what could have been. 537. Now, 555 in the occult world means extreme death. In the Bible, King Solomon used to collect 666 talents of gold from the 12 tribes of Israel. Now, when you divide 12 into 666, it equals to 55.5 each. So is that another coincidence? The reason I wrote the book is that when I looked up my number 5307 in the Christian Bible, It means that I am a representative of a God or kings to other nations and kings for the goodness and the salvation of mankind. So I honestly feel that I'm a messenger. And today I just wanted to express my sincere knowledge, my sincereness of waking up everybody and understanding that, you know, who ordered the MH370 to Kazakhstan was Mr. Putin. Who was involved with the people who backed it, the 600 million with Hussein Syzwani, was Donald Trump. So you wonder what they talked about in Helsinki 2 days ago in a private meeting. Well, who knows? Maybe it was about the gold. Maybe it was about Bitcoin. Maybe it was about the New World Order.
And I see a whole army of my countrymen here in defiance of tyranny. You've come to fight as free men. And free men you are. What will you do with that freedom? Will you fight? We will live. Die. Fight and you may die. Run and you'll live. At least a while. And dying in your beds many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom!
Fine speech. Now what do we do?
Just be yourselves.
Where are you going?
I'm going to pick a fight.
Well, you didn't get dressed up for nothing.